Chapter 14. Glory to the Rooster. Rimsky did not wait for the police report to be finished and fled to his office. He now sat at his desk and stared at the magical 10-ruble bills lying before him with swollen eyes. A steady hum came from the outside. Streams of people poured out of the Variety and onto the street. The financial director's extremely sensitive ears suddenly picked up the distinctive trill of a police whistle. By its very nature, the sound did not bode well. No sooner did he glance through the window facing out on Sadovaya than his face twisted and he hissed rather than whispered, "I knew it!" In the bright glare of powerful streetlights, he saw a lady wearing only a chemise and violet underwear on the pavement below. There was a hat on her head, however, and an umbrella in her hands. An excited crowd encircled her. Some gentleman darted round the lady, trying to tear off his summer coat, but too agitated to free his arm, which was stuck in one of the sleeves. Shouts and roaring laughter came from another spot, by the left entrance, and turning his head, Grigory Danilovich beheld a second lady, this one in pink undergarments. She had leapt off the road and onto the pavement, aiming to hide in a doorway, but the emerging people blocked her path. Deceived by the vile fagot's store, the poor victim of her own frivolity and love of garments dreamt of but one thing, to be swallowed up by the earth. A policeman headed for the unfortunate woman, piercing the air with his whistle, and several happy young men in caps hurried after him. Suddenly, in the dead silence of the office, the phone itself exploded in sound, right in the financial director's face, and he flinched and went cold. "My nerves are seriously upset, though," he thought, as he picked up the receiver. He drew back from it the same instant, and grew whiter than paper. A quiet female voice whispered from the receiver, "Don't call anyone, Rimsky, or else." The financial director put down the receiver. All telephone calls were now completely out of the question. He listened. The theatre was silent. Rimsky realized that he had been alone on the second floor for some time, and an insurmountable, childlike fear took hold of him at this thought. The idea of crossing the empty hallways alone and descending the stairs made him shudder. He feverishly grabbed the hypnotist's tens off the desk, put them in his briefcase, and coughed to give himself a little courage. The clock suddenly began to strike midnight. Even the chimes caused the financial director to shake. But his heart truly sank when he heard the English key turning quietly in the lock. Digging into his briefcase with cold, clammy hands, the financial director felt that if the rustling in the keyhole were to last even a little longer, he would cave in and let out a piercing scream. The door finally yielded to someone's efforts and opened. Varyonika stepped noiselessly into the office. Rimsky sat down in the chair right where he stood, for his legs buckled underneath him. "God, how you frightened me!" Without taking off his cap, Varyonika went to a chair and sat on the opposite side of the table. "Why didn't you call? What's the meaning of all that nonsense with Yalta?" "Well, it's just like I said," the manager replied. "They found him in the tavern at Pushkino."
"What do you mean, in Pushkino? Just outside Moscow? What about the telegrams from Yalta?"
"The hell they were. He got Pushkino's telegrapher drunk, and they both started messing around, sending telegrams marked Yalta, among other things."
"Yeah, aha. Well, okay." "Okay, details," Rimsky said, tapping a paperweight on his desk.
And so Varyonika began to narrate the details. As soon as he got to where the financial director had sent him, he was received at once and most carefully listened to. No one believed for a minute that Stiopa could be in Yalta. Everyone immediately agreed with Varyonika's theory that Likhodiev was in Pushkino's Yalta.
"Where is he now?"
interrupted the excited financial director.
Where else? The manager replied with a crooked grin. In the drunk tank, of course.
Well, well.
Meanwhile, Veronica went on with his story, and the further he got, the more vivid became the lengthy chain of Lihoriev's subsequent indecencies and atrocities. How about the drunken dance with the telegrapher on the front lawn of Pushkino's telegraph? The pursuit of some ladies who were screaming in terror? The attempt to beat up the bartender at the Yalta itself? The breaking of a taxi's meter when the driver would not let Stiopa in the cab? In other words, a nightmare. Stiopa was well known in Moscow's theatrical circles, and everyone knew that the man was no joy to deal with. But still, the manager's tale seemed a little over the top, even for Stiopa. Yes, a little over the top. Perhaps even a lot. Rimsky's piercing eyes cut into the manager's face from across the table. The more lifelike and colourful the despicable details tacked on by the manager, the less the financial director believed them. When Veronica informed him that Stiopa had lost it to the point of resisting those sent to return him to Moscow, the financial director firmly knew that all that the midnight visitor had told him was, all of it, lies. Lies from the first word to the last. Veronica never went to Pushkino. Nor did Stiopa himself. There was no drunken telegrapher, no broken window in the tavern. No one bound Stiopa with ropes. None of it happened. As soon as the financial director became firmly convinced that the manager was lying, fear began to crawl along his body from the feet up. Without taking his eyes off the manager, the financial director thought of only what it could all mean. Why would the all-too-late returned manager lie to him so brazenly in this empty and silent building? The financial director stared at Veronica's face. There was something far more bizarre than the slanderous and, for reasons unknown, fictitious tale of Pushkino escapades, and that something was the change in the manager's appearance. The financial director managed to see a gigantic bruise on the right side of his face near the nose. Besides that, the usually full-blooded manager was now covered in a sickly, chalky pallor. Factoring in the disgusting habit of sucking and smacking acquired by the manager during his absence, his significantly altered voice, now hollow and coarse, and the shiftiness and trepidation in his eyes, one could easily say that Ivan Savelyevich Veronica had become completely unrecognizable. Rimsky extended his hand suddenly, his fingers playing along the tabletop, and, as if accidentally, pressed the button of the electric bell with his palm. The button sank lifelessly into the plane of the desktop. The button was dead. The bell broken. The financial director's guile did not escape Veronica.
What are you ringing for?
Just a reflex, the financial director replied. What's that on your face?
Car skidded, hit myself on the door handle,
Veronica replied, averting his eyes.
He's lying,
the financial director exclaimed mentally. And then his eyes grew round and absolutely mad as he stared at the back of the chair. Behind the chair on the floor lay two overlapping shadows, one thicker and darker, the other faded and grey. The shadows cast by the chair's back and sharp legs showed clearly on the floor, but the shadow of Veronica's head was missing above the back. Just as the shadows from the manager's legs were not among those of the chair's legs.
He is not casting a shadow, Rimsky cried desperately in his own head. He began to shake.
Veronica looked back furtively, following Rimsky's crazed glance to beyond the chair's back, and realized that he had been exposed. He rose from the chair. The financial director did the same.
and stepped back from the table, clutching his briefcase. "You guessed it, you bastard. Always were the clever one," Veronica said. Suddenly, he jumped from the chair to the door and quickly pushed down the latch of the English lock. The financial director looked round in desperation, retreated towards the window facing the garden, and in that moon-flooded window he saw the face of a naked girl pressed against the glass, her bare arm reaching through the vent, trying to open the bottom latch. The top one was already open. It seemed to Rimsky that the light from his desk lamp was fading, and the desk itself tilting. An icy wave washed over him. But fortunately he overcame himself and remained on his feet. The remainder of his strength went into a whisper, not a scream. "Help!" Veronica hopped around by the door he was guarding, remaining in the air for long periods of time. He kept waving at Rimsky with crooked fingers, hissing and smacking and winking at the girl in the window. She hurried, stuck her head of red hair through the vent, extended her arm as far as she could, and began to claw at the bottom latch with her fingernails, shaking the window frame. Her arm began to stretch as if made of rubber, and turned putrid green. Finally, the dead woman's green fingers clasped the knob of the latch, turned it, and the frame began to open. Rimsky cried out weakly, leaned against the wall, and thrust out his briefcase like a shield. He understood that his end had come. The frame swung wide open, but instead of the fresh night air and the aroma of lindens, a crypt-like stench tore into the room. The dead woman stepped onto the windowsill. Rimsky clearly saw the spots of decay on her chest. And then a joyous, unexpected crowing of a rooster came from the garden, from the low structure behind the shooting gallery, where the various birds used in performances were kept. The raucous, trained rooster trumpeted his announcement that dawn was rolling into Moscow from the east. Savage fury distorted the girl's face, and she let out a hoarse curse, while Veronica squealed by the door and tumbled from the air onto the floor. The rooster's cry came again, the girl clacked her teeth, and her red hair stood on end. At the rooster's third cry, she turned and flew out, following her, leaping and extending horizontally in the air so that he resembled a flying cupid. Veronica floated slowly over the desk and out the window. White as snow, without a single remaining black hair, the old man, who had recently been Rimsky, ran to the door, undid the latch, opened the door, and dashed down the dark corridor. Out on the street, he felt somewhat better. He ran across the broad street towards a dim red light hovering on the corner by the movie theatre. No one had managed to grab the taxi. "To the Leningrad Express with a good tip," the old man said, panting and clutching his heart. 5 minutes later, the express disappeared from underneath the glass dome of the train station and vanished entirely in the darkness. Rimsky vanished with it.